Good morning, everyone. Ready for another day? Good. Are you comfortable over there? Right, I think we have lots to get through today. So fasten your seatbelts. You know, when I get down on my knees in front of the Buddha, I think to myself, can I just be like this for the next 2.5 hours? All sorts of things just flood through my mind. Just the mere fact that I have the opportunity to do that. Just to be like that, just to be at his feet, just to reflect on who he was and how fortunate we are to call ourselves disciples of the Buddha. You know, if you ask me who the Buddha was some years ago, I'd probably have read you a chapter of a history book or something. A man who lived 2,500 years ago. And I'd tell you that his name was Siddhartha. He was born to a great king. And then he was supposed to be either a wheel-turning monarch, or he was to go on to become a Buddha. And I would speak to you about a man from the book of history. But then I began this expedition of learning what he taught, what he discovered. And then today, if you ask me who the Buddha was, I'm speechless. It seems like the more I know about him, the less I can actually tell you who he was. Today, to be quite honest, if you walked up to me and asked me, Swaminarayan, can you tell me who the Buddha was? I'd just stare at you and you'd stare at me, and that would simply be a staring contest. I wouldn't know what to say, because I wouldn't know where to begin. And for each and every one of you in the room, you will have your own version of the Buddha. That's a fair deal. For each and every one of you, the Buddha will mean something different. The profoundness that the Buddha represents, what he stood for. If I asked you, let me just take I'm not saying that they're equals, but just to give you an idea, if I asked you, let's go back to before you learnt about Mahatma Gandhi, and I asked you who Mahatma Gandhi was, you would have said he was a great man who lived in India many years ago, and he fought a war of non-violence to unite a nation. And then you started to learn about Mahatma Gandhi, and then you began to understand what his methods of non-violence were. Even to this day, there are those who like him, there are those who dislike him. But if you are someone who is fond of him, then these people, they have a special place in your hearts. And that all comes with knowing what they stood for, knowing what they represented, knowing what their purpose was on this planet. That's why I say today, if you ask me who the Buddha was, to be quite frank, I'm speechless. And that coming from a monk seems quite ironical, doesn't it? Because as a monk, I'm supposed to know who a Buddha was. I'm supposed to be able to tell you who the Buddha was, but alas, I could do a better job when I was a layman. He's infinite. Ask me how big infinity is. You know how big infinity is. You just know it, but you can never express it, right? It's one of those concepts. You have a vague idea as to what infinity is, but you can never put a number around it. You can't wrap your head around it. You just know that it's there. It's infinite. That's what infinity is. In the same way, if you ask me who the Buddha was, no words to describe. Yesterday, in yesterday's sermon, we were talking about metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha, and how that should be the foundation of one's practice. And as much as people wish to think that understanding, learning Buddhist philosophy and practicing it is about the satara satipatthana, kaya anupassana, vedana anupassana, chitta anupassana, dhamma anupassana, and that is right. But these practices must be built on the foundations of metta, karuna, mudita and upekkha. Without that, it's not going to last very long. And then I myself asked the question, and as soon as I asked it, I realized that I don't have the answer to this question. So I asked the question, so what, ladies and gentlemen, is metta? And then I realized, I don't have the answer. I shouldn't have asked that question. What is metta? How do you describe what metta is? Metta is like the infinite sky. I can only give you analogies. I can give you similes, I can give you maybe metaphors, but how do you explain what metta is? Metta is like the infinitely vast ocean. It's accepting everyone as if they are you. That's metta. But I know that doesn't describe what metta is. And then I said the metta is Buddha. That is what metta is. And the Buddha is metta. They are synonymous. To me, the Buddha is synonymous with metta. We often say he is the fount of metta. He's a fountain of metta. He is a source of metta. And it's easy to think that I'm referring to an individual. I'm actually talking about Buddhahood. Buddhaness. That's a noun that I just invented. Buddhaness. You know, there are soft things and there is softness, isn't there? I'm talking about that. I'm talking about Buddhaness. It is what all bodhisattvas aspire for, or aspire to. On his quest, our bodhisattva, he went looking for someone. On his quest for liberation, he went looking for someone and he found him. We use the word him, but we don't really mean him. You know, the bodhisattva, just as you and I, the bodhisattva went looking for someone. Who do you think that he went looking for? He went looking for the Buddha. Our bodhisattva, he went looking for the Buddha. And he found him. He found him under the Bodhi tree. But that was the coming to fruition of a journey that he had taken many, many years ago. That's when he started that journey. But he found the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. But that was not another man. He realized that he was the Buddha. What he discovered was Buddhahood, Buddhaness. He discovered metta. He discovered compassion. He discovered loving kindness. He discovered karuna. He discovered softness. He discovered mercifulness. These words will mean something to each and every one of you. I know that. If you are a mother or a father, you may have some idea of what this means to your own children. Mata yata niyam puttang ayusa eka putta manurakki in the Karanimata Sutra. As a mother extends her love and kindness and compassion to her only son, as such should we all spread loving kindness and compassion to all sentient beings, to all. Like a mother to her only child, are you able to spread your compassion and loving kindness? Can you think of all human beings including those who speak against you, including one who might think that you are their enemy, including one who might come and take away from you your nearest and your dearest? Can you think of them and love them? This is a very special kind of love, ladies and gentlemen. This is not the I scratch your back, you scratch mine kind of love. That's a very selfish love. And you know that love is selfish because once the scratching stops, then the two depart. But I speak of a love like a mother has towards her own child. No matter what, no conditions. Come what may, whether you please me or not, whether you're a murderer or not, it doesn't matter. To a mother, her child is always precious. In that manner, can you conduct yourself? Can you have love and loving kindness and compassion to all sentient beings? That, to me, is Buddha. To be able to get to that state of mind is Buddha. So what is Buddha? Someone who lived 2,500 years ago? How can you say it in those terms? That was just a man. He died. We say he passed away into Parinibbana. We are talking about a mind. We are not talking about a man. We are talking about a mind. We are talking about a state of mind. We are talking about a quality. That's why they say the Buddha's qualities are how many? Infinite. So how can you wrap your head around what infinite is? So if you had to talk about the Buddha, you have to talk about an infinite number of qualities and then say that's the Buddha. When do you start? Where do you end? If I ask you to come up here and give a speech on compassion, if you ask me to give a speech on compassion, let's say I could speak for 2 days straight, but that's not infinity, is it? So I still have not described compassion as the Buddha understands it and as the Buddha expounds it. So when I get down on my knees in front of him every day, I thank my lucky stars. My lucky stars are my teachers, the stars that guided me to his feet. I was not always like this. I was the center of the universe once. Are you still? I don't know. I thought I was a very important man. I thought people should get to know me. That's what I thought. I hadn't even begun to get to know who I was. And yet I thought that people had to know me. So whenever I'd walk into a room of strangers, I'd introduce myself so that they could know me. So they could know me. They had to know me because I was important. But today I realize I'm nothing. You know, when I realize fully that I am nothing, I'll be everything. For as long as you think you are something, you can't be anything more than that. Oh, I like the sound of that. Where did that come from? Like I said, you know, I don't come prepared and planned to give these things. I sit down, you come here with all your merits, overflowing with merits, and we meet together, and then fireworks happen. For as long as you think that you are something or that you are someone, you can never be anything more than that. Because that's what your mind does. Your mind limits you to that, whatever it is you think. Because as soon as you think you are someone, you become an entity. You become fixed. That's what I am. I am that. But if you can become nothing, if you can become no one, then you are everything. See, atoms, they are everywhere, aren't they? Just to help you understand what I'm trying to get across to you, please remind me to do the namaskar in a moment. Atoms are everywhere, aren't they? Yeah. You don't have table atoms. You don't have chair atoms. You don't have microphone atoms. You don't have building atoms. You just have atoms. And because atoms are atoms, they're everywhere. they go into making up everything. Now, I know you're thinking the scientists here, the physicists here, but then there are carbon atoms and hydrogen atoms, Swami knows. Yes, I understand. Right. Let's go down one step deeper. You have to ignore that fact for a second. But let's go down one step deeper. You have protons. If you take a proton from a hydrogen atom and you put two electrons around it. You take two protons, or you take one proton and one electron. Now you have a hydrogen atom. Take another proton, take another electron. Now you have a helium atom. That's all they are. They're just protons. They're just electrons. And then you have neutrons. That's all they are. That's because they are nothing themselves, they're everywhere. So therefore they're everything. See, if you take this saucer, you have atoms. If you take look at the desk, the chair, the table over there, the stool over here, there are atoms. But there are no saucer atoms. There are no stool atoms. If you go down further and take the protons, there are protons that make this up, there are protons that make that up. In fact, you could take the same protons that make up the stool and reconstruct, rearrange them, and you get the saucer. You take the same protons and rearrange them, you get a carrot. You take the same protons and rearrange them, and you get you. Scientists believe that when the Big Bang happened, all of the universe and all of its contents were all in one place just a moment before that, a fraction of a second before that. And then it, faster than the speed of light, in a fraction of a second, the universe expanded, and then the atoms, the protons, the neutrons, and the electrons, as we know it today, they began to exist. So they have gone into making everything. That is because an atom or a proton doesn't identify itself as anything. A proton is nothing, therefore it's everything. Don't look at me like I'm speaking French to you. I'm sure that must have made sense to some of you at least. Because protons don't identify themselves as a stool, as a desk, as a human being, as an animal, as a building, as a sun, as a star, as anything. They go into making everything because they are nothing. That's why. So in the same manner, if you can become nothing, you can become everything. So right now, what we are trying to do here is to try and step outside these boundaries that we have put for ourselves. Remember, you're only limited by your thoughts. Do try and understand the profoundness and the gravity of what I try to get across to you. Not just the words, but what I actually mean by that. You are limited by your thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. If you think you are a mother, that's all you can ever be. You are a mother. In that moment, you are a mother. In that moment, you can't show loving kindness and compassion to a child that is not yours. In the same way that you can show loving kindness and compassion to your own child, because you are a mother. You are a mother to that specific child. See how you limit yourself? But what about the Buddha? You know, when we describe the Buddha, it is in Sinhalese, they say this, right? The love of 100,000 mothers. The compassion of 100,000 mothers. The loving kindness of 100,000 fathers. If you were to put together, it still cannot be compared to the loving kindness and compassion of a Buddha, right? That's because he does not identify himself as a mother to an individual. In his mind, he is limitless. But if you consider the atoms of his body, he was born to an average mother. He was born to Queen Mahamaya. He was born to King Suddhodana. There were people like you and I. And his lay son was the Prince Rahula. But do you think he loved Prince Rahula any more than he loved any other name you can think of? Sunita and Sopaka? Do you think he loved Prince Rahula, his own blood and his own blood? Do you think he loved Prince Rahula more than he loved Sunita or Sopaka? Not so. Because he had stopped identifying himself as a father. He was everything. You can reach that state of mind. You can. It is possible. It is well within your limits. It's well within your reach. All you have to do is to start thinking outside the limitations that you have set for yourself. Remember, think and you are. That's all. Right now, where are you? See, you had to think to answer that question. And now you are, right? There you go. You have to think and then you are. Let me give you another example. Who are you? Do you have a child? And as I ask you to think about your child, now you are a mother. Do you have a wife? And now you are a husband. Are you a doctor? Now you're young, you are one. How old are you? There you go, see? Now you are that old. I'm asking a chitta that was only just born. How can a chitta that is only just born be all that? It's not. It never is and it never was and it never will be. But think and that is what you are. So then if you can think that you are nothing, then you become everything. These riddles will start making sense, don't you worry. I don't intentionally try and speak in riddles. I'm still trying to find the words to describe what I'm going through, what I'm experiencing. Like, these are actual experiences that I have. Then what else do I have to do, right? I don't have to sit for exams, right, or stress myself out and worry over anything. All I do is reflect on the Dhamma, think about how I can share the message of the Buddha with as many people as I possibly can while I'm still alive. That's what I do. And for those who come seeking shelter, seeking our noble companionship, we give that as much as we can. That's how I spend my day. It's a wonderful life. This side of Nibbana, I wouldn't want to live another kind of life. This kind of Nibbana, this is paradise. But I know there's something more than this, and that is complete extinction. But then that will happen when it happens. Right now I'm on this side of that, right? So this side of that, this is perfect. Can you say the same about your lives? I don't know, just asking. If you can, touche. If you don't feel the same way, then come and see. Come into the Dhamma. Initially come into the Dhamma. Later on you can decide what you want to wear, right? But initially come into the Dhamma. Come and see the Dhamma. The Dhamma is enlightening. The Dhamma is enlightening. That's why there is no other way you can find enlightenment. This concept of enlightenment is a concept that is reserved for one who practices Buddhist philosophy. Not the Buddhist religion. Philosophy. Philosophy is something that your mind takes on, reflects, analyzes, understands, comprehends. That is what philosophy is. Enlightenment is a concept that is reserved, an experience that is reserved for one who sees the truth. So come see the truth. Come enlighten yourself. There is an answer to all the burdens that you have to endure day in, day out. I promise you, folks. I promise you. You don't have to suffer like you do. How do I know this? I read it in a book. How do I know that you don't have to suffer like this? I've been there and I've done that. I suffered just like you. Just like you, I suffered. You still have some sleepless nights, don't you? When you have to worry about your folks, you worry about your children, you worry about your husband, you worry about your father, you worry about your relations, you worry about your neighbors, you worry about your sister, you're worried about your brother, you're worried about your finances, right? You're worried about paying the bills. The heartache that it brings you, the sleepless nights, the nightmares that you have. You know, just go and ask your parents whether they're not worried about you. Go ask them if you don't know. When you get back home today, ask them, Amma, do you never worry about me? She'll say, put the kettle on, love. Where do I start? That's what she'll say. Because she's a mother. That's the thing. She's a mother. She's limited herself to being a mother. She's not everything. Because she's not a no one. She's a someone. She's a mother. So she has to worry. Worry is part and parcel of being a mother. Mothers? Yes or no? If you are a mother, then this is part and parcel of your life. You have to worry. Of course you have to worry. It's almost in your genes to worry. It feels like that, doesn't it? It feels like it's in your genes, like you can never get out of it. If you're a father, now you have to worry about your family. Sir? Any good father is worried about his family. He's worried about the well-being of his children. He's worried to make sure that his family is looked after, fed, sheltered, protected, all these things. Any good father has to worry. But that's the thing. That's a good father. You know, in Buddhist teaching, we try and show you what's bad about good. That's the funny thing. Did you know that goodness was the greatest obstacle to greatness? You can take that down. Goodness is the biggest obstacle to greatness. Wasn't the Bodhisattva a good man? Wasn't the Bodhisattva a good man? I don't even mean in his last birth. All the births before that, you've read the 550 tales of the Jatakas. Right? You might have read at least one or heard at least one or two of the stories. Was he not a good man? But was he a Buddha then? No, he was a Buddha aspirant. You know what he was trying to do? He was not trying to become a better man. He was trying to become a great man. See, a bad man needs to try to become a good man. In the Jataka tales, I have never yet come across a story where the Bodhisattva tries to be a better man, meaning someone who is more good. He's trying to go beyond, he's trying to transcend goodness. Do you understand what I'm trying to get across to you here? He was trying to transcend goodness because he'd stopped being a bad man the day he determined, I am going to become a Buddha. And as I do, I am going to save myself and every sentient beings. Every sentient being who comes into my horizon, I am going to take them all across the ocean of samsara and free them from suffering. That resolution he made. And on that day, he stopped being a bad man. He could not, because badness does not go hand in hand with being a Bodhisattva. You can't be bad and be a Bodhisattva at the same time. So from then on, his quest was not to be a more good person or a better person. He was aspiring to greatness. So the biggest challenge and the biggest obstacle to greatness is goodness. So if you are a good father, that's the problem. You're a good father. You're a good mother. I mean, you know, I respect you for being a good father and a good mother. I respect you. But I want you to be more than that. I see that potential in each and every one of you. I know that you can be more than a good mother. When you had your first child, mothers in the house, right? Did you not promise yourselves, I am going to be the best mother in the world? As you held your child in your arms, right? Take a trip back memory lane. As you held your child in your arms and you looked at that sweet little face, did you not promise yourself, I am going to be the best mother in the whole wide world? You did, right? I'm telling you, cut it out. Why settle for something so little? Why stop there? Why draw the line there? You needn't stop yourself at that. Why stop at goodness? You know, I see the potential that you have, and that is why I venture this way. That's why we make this effort to come and speak to you. In these words, I try to put some stepping stones so that you can go from goodness to greatness. This is a great man. I mean, his greatness is limitless. You can't even quantify how great he was. He's the epitome of greatness. The pure definition of greatness. That may be a goal that we can never reach, but even if we can come close, that's still good. An infinitely small fraction of infinite is how much? How much is an infinitely small fraction of infinity? It's still infinite, right? That's what I'm saying. So why don't we try and become an infinitely small fraction of infinity? What do I mean by this? We can't be the Buddha, that's okay, but let's try and be an infinitely small fraction of what the Buddha stood for. If whatever compassion he had was infinite, let's have an infinitely small amount of that compassion, because that is also infinite. And the Dhamma can do that. I promise you the Dhamma can do that. Like I said, look at me. I don't want you to see a hero. I'm not. I just want you to have faith in yourselves. That's what I want you to have. Look at me and have faith in yourselves. Can you do that? Can you look at me and then promise yourselves, if he can do it, I can do it? That's what I want you to do. Because I'm a very average human being. Cut me and I bleed just the same as you. I'm a very average human being. I went through everything that you're going through right now. All the heartaches, the ups and downs of life, fear, stress, worry, grief, complaints, moans, grievances, all that. You name it, I've been through that. Desire and lust, all these things, I've been through just as much as you have. So why do I share this with you? I'm a hero? No, you are a hero. You just haven't put your cape on yet. That's what I'm saying. I see the heroes within you. Look at me and have faith within yourselves. This is the invitation that I make to you. Tell yourselves, remind yourselves every single day as you wake up in the morning, if the first thought that comes to you is a Mahasangha, right? If you wake up every morning, you look at the Buddha, you offer a glass of water, whatever, right? You get down on your knees, you worship the Buddha, and the next thing that comes to you maybe is the monastery. Maybe the first thing that comes to your mind is Guru Hamdru. The Mahasangha. Right? If that's the first thought that comes into your mind, close your eyes for a second and tell yourself this. If he can do it, what? Well done to him. Huh? If he can do it, I can do it. Because it's the same Dhamma that helped me, I preach to you. The same thing. Word for word, letter for letter, syllable for syllable. No different. I will not share with you something I have not practiced. So therefore you must know that if this Dhamma has made this transformation within me, then it has to make the same transformation within you. So to everyone in this room I speak, I tell you, if today you suffer because of fear, you're worried about your children, you're worried about the future, you're worried about what might happen tomorrow, You're scared. You're worried at night. When the lights go out, you're worried. If you have to leave your family and you have to travel somewhere for work, right, you have to go and spend a couple of weeks, you have to spend a couple of months, you have to spend a couple of years. Now you're dead worried. What if, what if, what if? You're always going through this what if in your mind. So where's the time to be happy in life? You don't. You just don't have the time to be happy in life because you're going through fear and sorrow and grief and worry and all these things. So much so that stress is becoming fashionable these days, isn't it? You meet someone on the street, hi, how are you? Stressed. Oh, good, same here. It's almost like that now. It's almost like now, you know, to qualify for a job, you have to have had depression once in your life at least. Otherwise, they'll think like you're not committed to your work. So much so. It's become a pre-qualification for a job application. Every other man is stressed. Every person you see on the road, they're worried. No one's happy. Otherwise, why would two people who bump into each other accidentally then get into a brawl? And you know, honestly, that they're not actually taking out on each other a grudge or a grievance that they have with each other. You know that. Let's step on a stranger's foot and they're going to give you war and peace. They're going to tear you a new page. They're going to take out all the stresses that they have on you. Poor you. You know, you just bump into someone in a supermarket aisle as you go to do your shopping. Just look at how their face changes. That's because they were putting a mask on. As they stepped outside, they put a mask on. Because when you come out in society, you have to wear a mask. Right? But you give them the first opportunity to vent their frustrations. Oh God, they will. Because now they have an excuse. Right? You bothered them, so now they have an excuse to just vent it all out on someone. The poor shopkeepers, they get this every day. The people at the tills, they get this every day. Shortchange someone by mistake. I'm sure you must have been there when it happened. There's a young lady, she's working at the tills. That's how she pays her bills. That's how she keeps her family afloat. But shortchanged. By mistake, not intentional. Have you seen how some people have a go at them? Just because a mistake? These days there's no room for mistake. There's no room for mistake. If you make a mistake, that's the last mistake you will make. We can't be humans anymore, can we? Humans make mistakes, we used to say. But you can't be humans anymore. Because if you do make a mistake, then you will have hell to answer to. And that's not because people have a grudge with you. It's because people have all these frustrations all packed up inside, waiting for a moment, a moment's relapse. They're just waiting to get it out. And if you become the unfortunate one, then you're just going to get the brunt of it. And I'm sure you have seen this happen. Think of road rage. All you did was just pull up in someone and you didn't even see them coming. All you did was go and park in the parking space and you didn't know that was reserved. Remember what happened? You opened your door and just by mistake, you know, your door just rubbed against someone else's. Do you remember all the explicits that you heard as a result of that? Today's conversation starts with F, right? They start with F. Just think about, you know, why people's minds are like that. Why people start there. Can you imagine how much vented frustration or how much frustration they have packed up inside? They're boiling inside. All I have is sympathy. I mean, they need the Dhamma. They need the Dhamma. The other day, I was speaking to my mother last week when I had my weekly Dhamma sermon with her. And she was telling me, Swamin Mahansa, do you remember one day we were on the motorway, you were driving, and then some man drove past, and then he honked at you, and then you were annoyed. Do you remember how you responded to him? I was like, Amma, let's not talk about that. I was very embarrassed. But then soon enough I realized, you know, that was not me. So I needn't worry. It was just the chitta that was born at that time. So, but the truth is, I was actually quite ashamed as to how a chitta, when it's vexed, you know, that man who honked at me, he was probably, you know, maybe that was by mistake. Can that not happen by mistake? See, we never give people the benefit of the doubt, do we? We always assume that they do it in spite. We always think that. We always think that people do things to spite us. Because they want to avenge us. That's because we always feel victimized. Who's the culprit? We ourselves are the culprits. That's all the burning inside. That's all the it's festering inside. Right? That's why we always feel like people are just out to get us. But they're not so. Hurt people, what else can they do other than hurt people? So this is why we need the Buddha in our lives. This is why we need the Dhamma. Like I say, you know, I've been through all this, ladies and gentlemen, so I know that there is refuge. You don't have to starve yourselves like this. If you are thirsty today and you're suffering from the thirst of desire, fear not, for the Dhamma, the water of Dhamma will quench your thirst. Fear not. If today you suffer from the hunger of fear and worry, fear not. Because the Dhamma will sate your hunger. It will. I speak from first-hand experience. So I tell you again, I'm not here to be your hero. I'm here to remind you that if I can do it, you can do it. Have faith in yourselves. That's why I always ask you, when you put your hands together in veneration of the Buddha, I always ask you to renew your pledge of allegiance. You are here for that. To seek refuge. The Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha is a refuge. It is not just someone or something we go and offer flowers to. It's a refuge. We go to them because we need them. That's why we go to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. Don't you know you need them? Anyone who suffers needs them, need refuge. So that's what we are here for today. So let's bring our palms together in veneration of that great teacher, the great master, whose selfless sacrifice have bestowed upon us the truth, the wisdom, the path, and the liberation to it. May my prayer be to His holy name.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Now the good news is, to get to greatness, to become no one so that you can become everyone, to become nothing so that you can become everything, all you have to do is to understand the Dhamma. That's the beauty of it. You just have to understand the Dhamma. You don't even have to preach the Dhamma. See? I can do that part. You just have to understand it. See, when I say, please stand up, don't stand up. When I say please stand up, do you have to make a lot of effort to understand what I've just said? You don't, right? There is some effort that has to be made, but that is almost negligible. Because your mind has to do something called manosankara. But that you don't even know you're doing, and besides, you're doing it all the time anyway. See, that's the beauty of it. I'm not asking you to do anything that you wouldn't normally do. Have I ever asked you to give up anything? I might have asked you to give up the 10 unmeritorious deeds, but even that I don't think I have ever done to this audience, because I don't think you are a group of people who engage in such silliness. Unmeritorious deeds. It's not for people like you. It's unlike you. So really, I've never asked you to give up anything. All I'm asking you to do is to do what you do every day. Understand things. When your mother says, Pata, do you not understand that? When the postman comes and rings the bell, do you not understand that? Do you have to make extra effort for that? Do you have to ask someone, I heard something, what was that? No, you don't. You just understand. Like, you understand. In the same way, when the Dhamma is preached to you, just understand. Understanding is almost a passive process, isn't it? There is an active element to it, of course. The more you are engaged with these talks, the more you will understand it. By engaged, I don't always mean like, oftentimes I ask you rhetorical questions and all you have to do is think of the answer. Sometimes I ask you for the answers, but most of the time I ask you a question, I want you to think of the answer. So in these instances, on those occasions, do try and think of the answer. When I ask you to take a trip down memory lane and, you know, think about an experience you might have had where you've had to suffer because of whatever, right? Take an example from your past so that I can then give you the Dhamma, and then your lab of life is where the Dhamma is going to make sense for you. That's all you have to do. So really, there is no heavy lifting at all here. The only heavy lifting you have to do is up the stairs. Yes? After that, you come and put yourselves down on these seats, and then the Mahasangha does the heavy lifting. You know, I have to look at each of you in this room. From the gentleman and the lady right at the back of the room to the lady right at the front of the room, I have to scan your faces to make sure that you have understood what I have said. Talk about heavy lifting. Because it's not just enough for the good lady over here and the good lady over here to have understood what I'm saying, and you know, they're vigorously nodding their heads going, yep, yep, got it, Swami answer, got it, let's move on to the next one. Whereas someone at the back of the room goes, what? To me, they're both the same, so I have to pay attention to that as well. That's why it's helpful to sit yourself down so that I can see you from wherever I am. Even when we are in the other hall, I can still see with, you know, thanks to my glasses, I can still see towards the back of the room. So still we are a reasonably sized audience where I can actually scan your frowns and your smiles from even when you're at the back of the room. And when you're nodding in agreement and you're nodding because you've fallen asleep, I can tell the both of them apart. Right? Talk about heavy lifting again. These are elements of compassion. You know, if I sense that some of you are beginning to doze off, I purposely change the tone. I do it. Maybe I'll crack a joke or something, just to lighten it up a little bit, so that I can wake you up. Because I can't say, hey, you, lady at the back, get up. I can't say that. Because what if someone takes offense? You know, because you don't like to fall asleep. I know, you know, maybe you've had a long shift the previous night. And maybe you were up, you know, feeding your child. Right? Who knows what the reasons are. So, you know, if you point at someone and say, yeah, that man over there, why are you asleep? Right? It can be embarrassing. So instead of pointing out to individuals, what I have to do is to try and gauge the audience. You know, how are we shifting? What's the rhythm? Right? I have to be able to resonate with your heartbeat, right? Metaphorically speaking, of course. So this is heavy lifting. You don't have to do any heavy lifting. You just have to lift yourselves up, put yourselves down here, and then understand. We speak the same tongue, so all you have to do is understand. And that's all you have to do. That's the point I'm trying to make. That's all you have to do. The rest will happen. The Dhamma does the rest of it. So much so that you only have to do 5% and the Dhamma does 95%. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. It's amazing. It's like your detergent at home. Anyway, when you have to wash something, you've got stained clothes, whatever, right? You get some soap powder. You put it into the water, right? How long does that take? Fill a bucket of water, put your stained clothes, and put some soap powder. How long does that take? Less than 5 minutes, right? But then you have to leave it for how long? 20 minutes, half an hour, right? See, half an hour's worth of time, a worth of effort, the soap powder is doing, the detergent is doing. You only have to do 5 minutes worth of work. The Dhamma is just the same. That is because the Dhamma is so potent. It's like a magic potion. It's so powerful. I tell you, it changed a man like me. It has to be powerful, don't you think? It has to be. So, what we're going to talk about from now on, today, I want to try and help you break your attachment, sever your attachment. Well, to be quite honest, all I want you to do is to stop suffering, right? But that will happen when your attachment begins to eradicate. You don't need to take my word for it. As I preach the Dhamma to you, as you listen to the Dhamma, as you learn, as you understand the Dhamma, whatever causes were there for attachment to prevail, then those causes will cease. Okay? Whatever causes were there for attachment to prevail, for attachment to be there, those causes will cease. And when those causes cease, attachment will cease. What do you have to do? What's the part for you to do? Just understand. You don't even have to do it actively. See, you're understanding everything I'm saying. There's nothing to do. You just have to sit yourself down and listen to what I'm saying. That's all. Let your mind do the understanding part. Even that you don't have to do. So there's nothing you need to do to try and get rid of attachment. Now, most of you will already understand, will know that attachment is a devil. It's a demon. It's here to get you. Attachment causes suffering. You know that like the back of your hand. But I know most of you will be thinking, we know Swami knows that now attachment is what causes suffering, but how the heck do we get rid of it? It's there. I can feel it. It's there. How do I get rid of that? You don't have to get rid of that. That's the good news. The Dhamma will do that. All you have to do is understand. And here's the greatest thing about understanding. You can't understand something that is not true. I mean, if you already understand the truth, right? Let's say you think this is an elephant. That's what you understand. Okay? The only reason I can convince you that this is not an elephant and it's a fan is because it is not the truth. So I can give you evidence after evidence. I can give you fact after fact to convince you that this is not what you think this is not what you think it is, but rather it is a fan, because I can give you evidence to that. I can give you real life examples and evidence to prove this to you. The reason that you're attached to things is because you have a misunderstanding of the world. You misperceive the world. Your perception of the world is flawed. That's why you're attached to it. It's like a bad friend. You know, a liar. Why do people not like liars? If you knew that they were a liar, would you have a problem with them? You know, I'm going to present someone to you and I'm going to tell you, this man, everything he says is lies. Don't believe a word he says. Right? He's a liar. And you believe me, and he's a liar. You have anything to fear? Because you know now that he's a liar. Meaning, you can't be fooled. You can't be tricked, because you know that everything he says is a lie. So the only problem with a liar is when you don't know that he's lying. Because then you accept what he says as true. And if you accept what he says as true, Now you accept that as your worldview, and then from there on your actions will be determined by what he or she has said. And that might lead you to disaster. So the only problem with a liar is when you don't know they are a liar. Do you agree with me on that? What's the problem with poison? I have a bottle. Let me see my imaginary bottle. Okay? Only I know that it's poison. You think it's mango juice. What's the problem? That's the problem, isn't it? Is the problem that it's actually poison, or is the problem that you think it's something else? Exactly. Let me draw this table out for you and you will understand this. You tell me, in which of these situations would you drink this? Right. So we have a bottle. We have a bottle here. A bottle in which there is actual poison. Okay? Here you have a bottle of something that is not poison. Let's just say it's water. Okay? On this side of the table is what you know about this. What you know, your understanding about the contents of this bottle. This is just a bottle, right? It's just a vanilla bottle. We don't know what's in there. It could be poison, it could be water. Here's what you know. You think that this is poison. You think that this is water. Okay? And the bottle of water now. You think that this is poison. You think that this is water. Okay? Which one of these situations is the most dangerous? Let's work through them. Excuse me. Let's take a bottle of water. You think the bottle of water, this bottle that actually has water, you think it has poison. Is that a problem? Are you going to die? No. I mean, you might die of thirst because you think it's poison, so you don't drink it, right? But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about dying because of drinking poison, consuming poison, right? This situation here is not a problem. What about this situation here? This is what you know. You think it's water and it is water. Problem? No. So no problem there, no problem here. How about here? It is poison and you think it's poison. Are you going to die? No. What about this? It's poison, but you think it's water. Now what's going to happen? Now you're going to drink it. So of all these combinations, this is the harmful one. So to prevent death, to prevent harm, if you had a bottle of poison, all you have to do is to know that what's in it is poison. You don't have to throw away the poison. See? This is okay. Now, don't you have things at home, like maybe some medicines or maybe some, fertilizer, right? You use in your garden. If you consume it, then that's going to be poison. But you keep it at home, no one drinks it. But why do you still keep it at home? Shouldn't you be throwing it out because it's poison? No. But why do you keep it? Because you put a label on it. It might come in a red bottle, right? It might come in a cap that, you know, a kid cannot open. You have to press it down to open it and, you know, various other gimmicks to be able to open that. So these are this is poison, poison to the human body, but as long as you know it's poison, that's okay. So poison that you know is poison is not poisonous. It's not harmful. But when you have poison and you don't know it's poison, that's when you might drink it. That's when it's harmful. So here's what we're trying to do. I'm trying to educate you about this situation, or to help you come out of this situation, to help you to realize that poison is poison. Like I said, all you have to do is understand. You don't have to throw the bottle away. That's the thing. Today, you might be attached to maybe some kind of food. Okay? Let's say some of you maybe, you know, you like wine. Why are you looking at me like that? Ah, okay. Biscuit. Okay, biscuit, right? You like your biscuits. Not wine, you like your biscuits. So if you like your biscuits, I am not asking you to throw the biscuits away. Not for one moment am I suggesting you should throw the biscuits away. I just want you to understand that it's poison. Don't throw it away. It's poison to the mind, not poison to the body. Biscuits were never made to please your mind. Biscuits are a type of food. Food for the body is not food for the mind. But you know, both you and I know, that today biscuits are not made to please the body, to satisfy the body, to sate your hunger. It's actually to please the mind. In fact, you know that's what biscuits are for, right? Otherwise, why would people make biscuits? It's not a staple item of food, right? But people make biscuits because it's confectionery. Most items of confectionery are to please what? The mind. But that's not what food is for. You know, food is like a drug. It's the most potent drug. It's the most healthy and the most unhealthy. Food is a drug. Take it to its right proportions and take it for its right purpose, and it does no amount. It does a lot of good to you. But you take it for the right, for the wrong purpose. You take it over and above the quantities that you're supposed to take, and it does a lot of harm to you. It's not the body that decides that. It's the mind, because an understanding is in the mind. The understanding is not in the body. Your body understands this much. It understands when you put something through your mouth, your body understands how to deconstruct it, how to decompose it, and then compose it back into something that the body needs. That your body understands. Does it not? That's why you don't look like a carrot. Although you eat carrots. Because your body understands the dynamics of how to break down a carrot and make skin out of it, make muscle out of it, make bones out of it. You see, your body understands that. But your mind doesn't. And that's why you suffer. You suffer because when you see a bottle of poison, you think it's water. And therefore, what do? You drink it. So what we are trying to do here then, what we are trying to understand now, is to understand that poison is poison. Once you've understood that, should you take the bottle and throw it down the sink? No, just let it be. So leave those biscuits. You don't need to throw them away. I don't expect any of you, even on a poor day, to go home and throw your biscuits away. Don't do that. You know, that is no symbol of your virtue. You don't have to throw away all your nice clothes. You don't have to throw away, you know, the things that you're attached to. You don't have to throw away any of these things. Remember, you don't need to throw away the bottle of poison. You just need to understand it's poison. That's all. Coming back to the point I made right at the start, it's simply to understand. That's it. So if ever you feel that you need to do more than understanding, then you're going down the wrong path. Please remember that for the rest of our interaction with each other. If ever you feel that you have to do more than understanding, okay, that is not something that I have asked you to do. That is not something I have asked you to do. With the exception of the unmeritorious deeds. If you wait until you have understood that they are bad, remember the consequences will still be just as bad. Whether you understand it or not, the consequences will be just as bad. But with everything else, your TV, your favorite music, your favorite food, if you like to go places, right, your friends, your parties, and whatever, these are not bad things per se. These are not unmeritorious deeds. These are not sins. Right? These are just experiences that you have to please your senses. Actually, not your senses, but your mind. This is, simply put it, is in one word, this is sensuality. Right? But that's because your mind does not understand that poison is poison. It prolongs your journey in samsara. That much it does. In other words, it creates another moment of suffering. That much it does. But you can't force yourself out of it, because that will be even more suffering. See, if there's something you really like to eat and you have to go and put it in the trash can, does that not hurt you? So how can the path out of suffering be another suffering? Think about it for a second. The Buddha cannot be preaching that sort of philosophy, can he? There's a favorite dress that you have. Right? And you think, I have to give up my attachment to this, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw it away. And you can't make your mind up for it because you're still strongly attached to it. Now, giving it away or throwing it away hurts you just as much. So, that is not what the Buddha advised. Of course, you can give it for charity and earn some merits out of it, but that's not the way to free yourself from attachment. Giving away everything you have does not reduce your attachment one bit. Now you're simply in a situation where you're still attached, but you don't have it. Now you're still thinking about it. This is why sometimes you give something to someone, right? And then you go and keep checking whether they're using it. No? You buy something for someone, or you give away something that was a treasure of yours, you give it to somebody, right? Every time, every other time you go around to their place. Where's that dish I gave you? Where's that ornament I gave you? Is it in the bedroom? You haven't given up. You've given to, not given up. Giving to someone and giving up something are different things. See, to give up, you have to understand. That's it. Understand that poison is poison and let the poison be. It's not going to hurt you, it's not going to harm you. So let's understand that poison is poison. How do we do that? Is it me or is it a bit warm in here? It is, isn't it? I can manage, but if you're feeling uncomfortable, then maybe do something about it. Because after a while I'll have to start singing lullabies. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that, okay? Make yourself comfortable. We're not ascetics. We're not here for austere practices. We're here to free the mind from suffering, that's all. So make yourselves comfortable. If it's too warm in here, then please let someone know. You don't have to endure and suffer. What are we here for? Huh? To free ourselves from suffering, right? So why should you suffer then? I mean, if it gets too hot in here, let's go out, sit outside and do the sermon. With the breeze flowing in through our air. Excuse me. Is that okay? Sure? Okay. Right. So let's try and understand that poison is poison. It is always your actions that bring you suffering. Your actions are determined by your thoughts. Your thoughts take the shape of your intentions. So ultimately, your intentions bring you suffering. This is why I want you to understand that the things that you're attached to are not what you think they are. Once you begin to understand that the things that you are attached to are not really what they think they are, the things really what you think they are, your attachment to them begins to cease. Like the example of the bottle of poison. To get someone to stop drinking poison, all they have to do is to convince them that this is poisonous. Now, you may have some experience of this when it comes to trying to get someone off the habit of smoking. See, the government, medical authorities, right, schools, on TV, on social media, right? You see a lot of publicity going on about the harmful effects of smoking. What do you think they're trying to do? They want to educate you, don't they? They try to educate you about the harmful effects of smoking. But they don't take the cigarettes away. They don't take the tobacco away. If you go into the shop, you can buy a box of tobacco. You can buy a box of cigarettes. But what they do is, they put the cigarettes out there because people want it. Because there are those who have understood and there are those who haven't understood. What right do they have to decide what you're going to do? Now, some might have strong feelings about this, so please put your emotions to aside. I'm only trying to get a point across to you. Okay, there may be some here who feel that no, smoking should be banned, right? And the government should be more responsible and take out all the cigarettes from all the, and so on, right? But that's not what I'm trying to explain to you here. I'm saying, look at what's going on right now. For those who wish to smoke, you can buy your cigarettes. You can buy your tobacco. For those who wish to take alcohol, you can buy your alcohol. But what the government does, what the schools do, what the medical authorities do, right, is they keep on educating people. There are plenty of people who didn't used to smoke, but their friends came and educated them before the government did. Remember that? Where did that start? Machan. Have one. That was your friend's education. So when you took that education, you started smoking. Perhaps not knowing the harmful effects of smoking. The first time, the first puff you took, maybe you coughed and it was a bit harmful, but they said, it will go away, carry on. One after the other, and you got used to it, right? And then sometimes you might have even become a chain smoker. But then one fine day, someone walked up to you and said, "Mister, do you know that smoking kills? Do you know the harm that smoking does?" And then they might have shown you a video, maybe on YouTube or something, where they have this bell jar and they have cotton wool inside it, and you light these cigarettes up and how the white cotton turns dark because of the tar that the cigarettes contain and so on, right? And then you were shocked. And then they showed you maybe pictures, right? Pictures of lungs of cancer patients who doctors believe they had the cancer because they smoked and so on. And the oral cancers and so on. So people showed you that. having seen that, you thought to yourself, good gosh, is this what smoking does to me? And then they said there are so many chemicals in a cigarette, all of which are harmful to you. And then as you learn this information, you stopped smoking. You chose to stop smoking. Did smoking get banned? No. You can still go back and smoke if you wanted to. But your knowledge of it, your understanding of the truth today has given you the wisdom that you need to give up smoking. That's what happened. Everything is like that in this world. Right now you're attached to things. You're attached to things because you believe, it's like smoking. You're attached to things because you believe they give you happiness. That they have pleasure to offer you. That they complete your lives. You feel that they have the potential to fulfill your lives. And therefore you attach yourselves to them. When you see this flower, you think it's beautiful. Remember, you think it's beautiful. You think it's beautiful. So much so that you think that beauty is in it. Because you think beauty is in it, you're attached to it. And when you're attached to it, now, with attachment comes fear and with attachment comes grief. That much you know, I think. And you all know how attachment leads to suffering, but what you're struggling with is, how do I get rid of attachment? So now here are some of the things that's going to happen to this flower. Someone's going to take it from you. Sometimes it's someone, sometimes it's Mara. Sometimes time takes things from you and then you suffer. You know that, but you can't get rid of that attachment that you have. This substitute this for your mother, your father, your loved ones, right? One day, what's going to happen? This is your child when he's born. This is your mother when she dies. And you suffer. You know now, attachment is what causes suffering, because you know that it doesn't happen to you when the mother next door dies. So you know that there's a special bond that you have with your own mother, and that is your attachment to it. But how do you get rid of it? How do I get rid of my attachment to my mother? That's the wrong question to be asking, unfortunately. The truth is, you can't get rid of your attachment to your mother for as long as you think it's your mother that's there. For as long as you think it is your mother who's there, you can't get rid of that attachment, because you create a mother in your mind. At the moment you create a mother in your mind, whether the human dies or not, you're still attached to mother. Let me say that again. So pay attention. When you're attached to your mother, you think this is the mother, this is the human being. The body will break and the mother will die. Your attachment is to your mother. Your mother is a concept that is created in your mind. That didn't die, did it? That didn't die. You still think of your mother. But when you create this concept of a mother, you want to project that onto something. Because you think a mother is a real person. Yeah? You think your mother is a real person. So therefore you project it onto someone that looks like a person. A human being. She has to be female, it has to be a human being. So the moment you see someone who fits the bill, you project that onto her. And now when they break, when they physically break, they die. But your mother in your mind is not dead. You are still looking for a mother. That's why, let's say she's on her, you know, she's last few days of her life, right? And you walk up to her room, you tap, no response. And then you start, you know, your eyes start welling up. But she bats her eyelids and you go, she's okay. She's okay. and for another day. She's okay. See, what didn't I? What did you think happened a moment ago? You thought she was dead. But what didn't die? The mother in your mind didn't die. And now she battered her eyelids. And now what happened? That mother that hasn't died yet? Yeah? You again project it onto this person and then she's alive. Thankfully, mother is alive. See, this is not about giving up your attachment to that mother. It's not about this. It's not about the object. For as long as you think the object, which is a creation of your mind, exists in the outside world, you try to do what, I mean, that's what science does. Science helps us to try and preserve the outside world object. You know, science will probably be pretty good nowadays that you can maybe preserve this flower for a few days actually. Right? Maybe there's a chemical that you can spray on it. Maybe you can put this in some kind of liquid and the flower will be intact for maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Who knows? And the more science advances, the longer that you can preserve this. You must ask why that has been necessary. It is not the death of this that people have a problem with. Because although this dies, in the mind there's something that's still alive. The flower. In other words, the mother, the child, the car, the wife, the boyfriend, the this, the that, and the everything. So when you create that in your mind, now you project that onto the outside world and expect the outside world to respond as you expect the creation of your mind to do. You expect the outside world object to respond accordingly. Now this is a little bit deep, I understand. But if you do try and pay attention, engage with me, you will understand it. I promise you. I'm not Einstein. I got it. You will get it. Let's try again. What I'm trying to get across to you here, ladies and gentlemen, is we create things in our minds. We create entities in our minds. We create mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and boyfriends and girlfriends and all these things we create in our minds. And then we expect some kind of object in the outside world to represent that. Because when you create something in your mind, it's simply a fragment of your own imagination, right? But now you need to fit detail into it. It's like a skeleton. But you need substance. You need substance to fill that skeleton. You need the muscles and the bones. And for that you use your five senses. So when you open your eyes, in comes rushing colors. It comes a rupa. This rupa, it comes and starts filling the shell, the skeleton. The skeleton is in your mind. Now, you know, I don't mean the mother's skeleton, right? I'm talking metaphorically here. You create a structure, and what you do with your five senses is use information about the world to give it more vividity, to give it color, to make it rich, so that you can actually experience it with the belief that it exists in the outside world. Take a simple example. Let's start with something simple. I went into the deep end, that's why. Let's come back, take something simple. Right? Let's take various kinds of breads. Okay, so all these breads, they're made from the same flour. But you have different recipes. You have different molds. Right? And into these molds, you mix your flour and you stick it in the oven. It comes out of the oven with different textures, different shapes, different sizes, right? But after all, is it not the same thing? So take a kimbulabanis. What's the English word for kimbulabanis? A crocodile bun? Crocodile bun. Right. You know, it's not just you in the sermon. There are people watching this online, right? So, crocodile buns. Now they'll wonder what's a crocodile bun. Come to Sri Lanka. Then you'll see what a crocodile bun is. Take a crocodile bun and just take a plain bun. Right? How do you make a crocodile bun? Flour, sugar, water, butter, right? These things you mix together, you stick it in the oven, and you get a crocodile bun. It's because of the mold. Right? It's because there's a mold that takes that shape, you have what you call a crocodile bun. Then you take a plain bun. A bun on which you sprinkle sugar. So sugar bun. Right? The same ingredients. A little bit different in texture, but that's only because of the way that you make it. And the shape. Right? So you put it into the mold, you take it out, and then it comes, has that shape, same ingredients, right? But ultimately it's the same thing, isn't it? But when you have the two of them on your plate, or when you're given a plate and you are asked to go and pick whatever you like to eat from the buffet, you walk up to the crocodile buns if you like the crocodile buns, you walk up to the plain buns if you like the plain buns. When ultimately they're both the same thing. But to you, they're different. Where is that difference created? Absolutely. Yes, madam. They're created in the mind. But it's not good enough for the mind to create it, because the mind simply creates a structure. And into this structure, you need to fill detail. You need information, you need data to make this rich, a rich experience. That's why you are born with your five senses. So you can live a very vivid life. It's not just enough to have mental images. I'll prove this point to you. Don't you sometimes fantasize about things? I'll just say things for now. When you fantasize about things, right, is that enough? Or do you then start making plans as to how you can experience that through your five senses? Take a young boy, for instance. Right? He is on his bed, looking up at the ceiling, and he's thinking about the girl that he saw in the class, in chemistry class. So he didn't learn any chemistry, but there was a lot of chemistry. So he's looking up at the ceiling, and now he's fantasizing. Her face, her hair. I wonder what his voice, what her voice is like. But if she's a pretty girl, as far as a boy thinks, if she's a pretty girl, ask her, even if he's never heard her voice, you ask him about her voice, what is he going to say? Remember, this is a boy who's never heard her voice. Just seen her from the end of the chemistry class, only seen her face, right? But you ask this guy, what does she sound like? I tell you what, he has an answer. He has an answer. He's going to say, she must have a sweet voice. I'm sure she has a sweet voice. So in this mental image, there's a sweet voice. But that's not enough. That's not enough. Now extrapolate along these lines and you try and work out why people watch porn. It's not enough. The mental image is not enough. You know, why should you settle for that when you have all your five senses? Now the mind enslaves the five senses. When you have a pair of eyes, why do you settle for mental images? This is what the mind's thinking. Because the mind is trying to create a uniform entity here. It's trying to create an entity because the mind seeks entities, the mind is thirsty for entities, the mind is hungry for entities, it begs for entities because the mind is thrilled by entities. It revels in entities. So the mind thinks, right, when can I satisfy my eyes so that I can take something to fit into this shell, into this structure? All I have right now is a skeleton. What do I mean by the skeleton again? Not the skeleton of the girl, I mean the skeleton as a metaphorically, just a structure. Now we need to put the muscles and the bones and fill it up with stuff. And to fill it up with this stuff, you use your eyes. So, next day, now the last time she was at the far end of the room, that was not enough. What if I can just get a closer view of her? So now he starts to speak to his friends, starts to speak to her friends, and starts planning how he can move a few benches closer to her. Ladies, do you remember how it all started? Gents, do you remember how it all started? So now you want to get closer to her because you want to get a better view. You already have a picture in your mind. You already have a picture in your mind. You just want to get a better view and see whether your picture in your mind is an accurate representation. Because that's what you want. What you want is has already been created. Right now you move up to her. You've only seen her like one side of her face. You've not seen the other side because you only saw her from one end of the room. Now you move up closer, closer and closer up to her. And now you're about a couple of benches away from her. For some reason she turns around. She turns around and she's got freckles on her face. You don't like it. She's got a big pimple here. And you don't like it. She's got a birthmark on here, down here, and you don't like it. This side of the face is fine. That's all you saw. See, you saw half of her face, and what did you create in your mind? The full face. Yeah, it's like when you see half the moon, don't you know the other shape of the other half of the moon? It's the same thing. Your mind is a supercomputer. It is capable of creating whatever you want. Using the very little information it has, it will stitch up the rest of it. Now you're a little bit disappointed. This is not the girl that you expected. So every time you're looking at her, you take in glimpses, you take in fragments of sight and you compare it with what you have in your mind, but it's not a match. So now you are beginning to feel disappointed. It's not what I wanted. It's not what I liked. But what if the other half of her face was also similar to the half you'd seen? Now it ticks those boxes. You are now experiencing pleasure. Remember, for pleasure to happen, it has to be a match. What does that tell you then? Pleasure didn't come from the outside. Can you clap with one hand? Does that not tell you that a clap is not in one hand? Shall I say that again? Can you clap with one hand? No. Does that not tell you that a clap is not something that you can find in one hand? A clap happens when two hands come together. Right? Meaning it's in neither hand. Yes, a clap is in neither hand. When it comes together, causes combine, and now there's a manifestation. The clap was not here, the clap was not here, but when they came together, now you heard the clap. Now tell me, pleasure. As you fantasized, that was not pleasure, that was a vexation. Right? The boy was on his bed, looking up at the ceiling, he was simply fantasizing, that was simply vexation, that was not pleasure. That's why he wanted to go see the girl. The girl doesn't have pleasure either. The girl doesn't have pleasure either. That's why she's still single. Because she doesn't float everybody's boat. Initially, you have to have an expectation on your part. But she doesn't have pleasure herself. She can't give it to you. But what happens is when you see her, now that sight and your expectation, these two things meet. And as an expectation is fulfilled, there is born pleasure. I really want you to understand this stuff, folks. This is the stuff, if you understand, you will realize that poison is poison. And then you won't drink it again. That's all. You're not going to go and throw it away. You just won't drink it. That's all. Let me explain that to you again. The boy is looking up at the ceiling. He's fantasizing. In his fantasy, he has an image of the girl. He's only seen one half of her face. He has not seen the other half. So now he imagines what the other half must be like. In his mind, can he not create the other half? Of course he can, because the mind can create mental images. He does it all the time. Does it all the time. So now the guy goes to the class. The girl's over there. He looks at her. She turns around and he sees the other half of the face. He didn't bring pleasure with him. If anything, he had vexation with him. Because to have vexation with him, he had the cause for vexation. What was that? He had the cause for vexation with him. What was that? Attachment. He had attachment with him, which is the cause for vexation, which is tanha. Tanha was with him. He's going to see Rati. But only tanha was with him. Now Rati turns around. She doesn't have pleasure either. And it's because she doesn't have pleasure, she cannot be giving, she doesn't give pleasure to everybody. Not everyone's happy at the sight of her. Certainly not in that way. But this boy, now that he has an expectation, that expectation is put forward. The sight of the girl is brought forward. When these two things collide, something that was not there before is born. Once again, something that was not there before, neither in the boy's mind nor with the girl, is born. Please tell me that you understand that pleasure then is not in the object. Exactly. It is a creation when an expectation meets the object that it expects. It is not in the object and it's not in the expectation either. Tell me again then, is this flower beautiful? Do I have in my hand a beautiful flower? You've used it to decorate the room, so you must think that it's pretty. When you dress up a bride, you put flowers on her head because you think it makes her beautiful, right? Don't you? That's why you use flowers to decorate, because you think the beauty of the flower is going to add to the beauty of the bride. What an insult. I don't know, if you ask me, that's an insult. It's like, you're not beautiful enough, so let's put a few flowers and make you look the shape. But even then, the principle is flawed. The principle is flawed. How do you know whether the person that's going to see her, see the bride, likes these flowers? Because then, if you want the bride to look beautiful, here's what you have to do initially. First of all, you have to go around telling all the people you're going to invite that these flowers, they're beautiful. You have to go indoctrinating people, teaching them about how beautiful these flowers are. That's the first thing you have to do. So in your invitation cards, you have to send a picture of these flowers, or at least pack one of these in the envelope and send it to them, and then indoctrinate them. This is about giving drushti. Indoctrinate them that these flowers are beautiful. Because how do they see the beauty in this flower when they come to the wedding? Expectation must meet the object. Can you give them expectation as they walk into the room? No, they have to come with that. They have to come with that, because expectation you can't give in the flower. Expectation is something that happens in the mind, so it has to create in the mind. In other words, they have to come with the expectation. You can only give the object. When these two things meet, now something that wasn't there before arises. That is pleasure. That must convince you then that pleasure is not in the object. In other words, beauty is not in the object. So if beauty is not in the object, why do you keep looking for beauty in the outside world? Why are there young men in this room who are waiting to find their princess charming one day? Why do you think that one day you're going to set your eyes on this beautiful girl that you're then going to get married to and live the rest of your life with? Why are there young ladies in this room who believe that you are yet to meet your Prince Charming? That's why they say, the man of my dreams. I mean, that is true. That's true. Because the dream is the fantasy. That's the expectation. So when expectation meets object, that's when pleasure is born. So pleasure is not in the object then. You have to come prepared. You have to come prepared Yes, you have to come prepared with your expectation. You know what it is to pair? Two things to be together. Yeah? So you have to be paired previously. So you have to come prepared with your expectation. And then when you come in contact with the object, how wrong is it then to think that it's the object that brought you pleasure? That's the ignorance from which I'm inviting you to step outside. I don't expect you to stop seeing beauty all of a sudden. Tomorrow I'll hold this flower up to you and you'll still say it's beautiful. That's okay. But I want you to understand where it came from. That is a victory on its own. If you can understand that it was not the beauty of the flower that you saw, but rather the expectation that you had in your mind, which was a vexation, the object that came from the outside, which had absolutely no pleasure about it. There was no vexation, there was no pleasure, it was simply equanimous. These things are neutral. These things are neutral. They don't give pain, they don't give pleasure. They're neutral things. But look at the value that you attribute to these things when you believe that they are of great beauty. When you walk into an art gallery, don't you see, the whole concept of art galleries and how some pieces of art are so valuable. Now, when you start seeing through this lens of the Dhamma, don't you realize that people have simply gone crazy? Look at how much value people give to those things, and people then sacrifice their lives to keep them safe. Like, let's say, now because it's me, you're not going to give this any value. But just imagine if I was Michelangelo and I drew this. That's enough. Yes? If I was Michelangelo and I drew that, that would go into an art gallery. And that would fetch maybe in the thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe in the millions. Where's the value in the object? Which part of this is the valuable part? What makes this beautiful? When you prepare yourself to step inside an art gallery, ladies and gentlemen, you already build up your expectations inside. You create that expectation in your mind and then you step inside. That's why to me, if I walked into an art gallery, I never learned how to appreciate art. You have to learn. What does that tell you about it? It's an acquired taste. In my younger years, right, I never learned to appreciate art. No one taught me. I like my music, but art was just not something that, because I have more of a computational brain, I think more like a scientist. So no one in my family enjoyed art either. So I never got that exposure. So if you took me into an art gallery, what I'll be saying is, you go around and come back when you're done, I'll just read a book or something. Even if the art gallery was filled with the pictures of, you know, the most talented artists out there, I just wouldn't be able to see the beauty in them, because beauty is not in them. You only experience beauty if you walk into the art gallery with an expectation in your mind. You have to pre-charge yourself. You have to prepare yourself with an expectation. My point is this: if that is so, why do you pay so much? Why do you want so much to be with something or someone that you think has intrinsic beauty? You know, this is the altar, the altar of beauty, as we once suggested it. This is the altar of beauty. People sacrifice their lives for the sake of beauty. People are prepared to kill for the sake of beauty. People are prepared to steal for the sake of beauty. They're prepared to engage in sensual sexual misconduct for the sake of beauty, because they see something they like and they think, I have to have it. And the sins that they commit, these are real sins. That's the thing. Although beauty is fake, the sin is real. It's a double whammy, isn't it? Look at how we pick up the short end of the straw. It is so pitiful, really, ladies and gentlemen. Although beauty is fake, the deeds that people do to be with what they think is beautiful, the effort that people go through to be in the presence of things that are beautiful, to acquire things that are beautiful, by hook or by crook, those deeds are very real deeds, and they come back to bite. In those moments you can't say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize that beauty was fake. Well, the deed was done. Because although the beauty that you see is fake, the jati that happens when the deed is done, the karma that happens when the deed is done, that is real. So for real karma, there is real vipaka. But for fake beauty, there's nothing accountable. Now ask yourselves, how much you put yourselves through for the sake of beauty. By beauty, I don't simply mean beauty that comes through sight, beauty that comes through smell, beauty that comes through taste. All of these things are expressions of beauty. But the fact of the matter is that beauty does not exist in these outside world objects. Your senses cannot give you beauty. They cannot. I need you to understand this, ladies and gentlemen. For your sake, please understand that your senses cannot bring you beauty, because beauty does not exist in the outside world. You have to go prepared with an expectation. These expectations, they are determined by the drushti that you take on, by the views that you take on in this world. Now come back to the point I was trying to make earlier, the deep end again. Let's give that another go. When your mother dies, or anything that is that you like, you love, you treasure, right? When something happens to something that you love, you like, and you treasure, what really happened was simply a change in the outside world. It's simply a change to energy in the outside world. A change to energy, a change to matter. That's all that happened. But here's what you've been doing all along. In your mind, you'd created a mother. Your mind, you created a mother. In your mind, you created a girlfriend. In your mind, you'd created a spouse. And you projected that image onto a physical object. That's what you did. That's why if you pick up the wrong child from the hospital, you project that to another child. It's entirely possible. See, some children are adopted. Right? And adopted, sometimes children are adopted at a very young age that they don't even know that they're adopted. Maybe some of you are and you don't even know it. So they grow up thinking that they belong to their biological parents, and that they live with their biological parents. They don't know that they've been adopted. So don't you see how this, is there any biological connection between an adopted child and the foster mother? Is there any biological connection between the two? There aren't. But if the child thinks that this is my mother, they create a notion of mother in their mind, and then don't they project it to this physical form that's outside? Yes or no? Yes or no? They project that. Now, if this is the physical form that they have just projected it to, what's going to happen when this happens? What's going to happen then? The child suffers. All because of a projection. All because of a mental creation. And they were not even the real mother. But didn't the child suffer just the same? So is it the death of the biological mother that causes suffering? Question time. Is it the death of a biological mother that causes suffering, or the death of the perceived mother? It's the death of the perceived mother. Then, do you understand why it is and how it is that an arahant can be unshakable when their perception of a mother disappears, disintegrates, eradicates? Now, it matters not what happens to the biological mother, because it is not the biological mother that brings you suffering. It is the perceived mother. You suffer, ladies and gentlemen, because of your perceived world, your perceived entities. You project these perceived entities onto things. These things, they are susceptible to change. Because all there is energy. And energy is in a constant flux. It comes and it goes. It flows. It changes from one form to another. But for a period of time, it will represent itself, it will present itself as one package. You know, just like this flower. See? Do you know how this flower came into being? Initially, it was just a seed. And then it took up sun, it took up the earth, it took water, it took nutrients from this environment, and all those things that it took, inside of this, it transformed it. There's ribonucleic acid. That's what a plant can do. Just like you have your DNAs, plants have their RNAs. They take in materials from the outside world and they transform them into things like this. This is this. Just in a different arrangement, that's all. But this arrangement you think is a fully formed flower, this arrangement you think is a disintegrated flower. It's all in your perception. If you are attached to this, when this happens, you're going to cry. It's not the death of the flower that caused you suffering and that is going to cause you suffering, is the death of your perceived flower. Like I said, you can't let go of anything. All you need to understand is there is nothing to let go. I've been saying this countless times now, and I'll keep saying it until the penny drops. See, this, is that not this? Is this not this, and is this not this, simply in another arrangement? But if you are attached to this arrangement, aren't you going to suffer in a moment? So do you see, if you in your mind are attached to this fixed entity, this is not a fixed entity, if you create a fixed entity out of this, if you believe that this is one unit and this is how it's supposed to be, if you don't see this as merely an aggregation of its causes, if you don't see it merely as an aggregation of its causes, you are going to suffer when something happens to this. And you don't. It's not only when something happens to it, because that's called grief. Even when it's intact, you are still afraid. You live in fear. What if? That's why when you see your child running across the street, you're afraid. Because you have a what if going through your mind. What if this becomes that? Isn't that the feeling that goes through your mind when your child runs across the street? What if this becomes that? But isn't this that? Isn't this the same thing? It's just a different arrangement. But in your mind you see, you don't simply see this as an arrangement. You see this as a package. This is how it's meant to be. This is a unit. This is an entity. And that entity is a creation of your perception. So even when this turns into this, your perceived entity still remains. It endures. It endures because your attachment is to that. Remember, these are mental creations, ladies and gentlemen. This has nothing to do with the physical world. Try and get that on board. It has nothing to do with the physical world. I know some kids who are attached to aliens. I mean, they're attached to aliens. They've never seen one. So that's what I'm saying. It just has nothing to do with the outside world. These are all creations in the mind. Just like a child can be attached to an alien that they have never seen, you are attached to your son that you have never seen. You are attached to your mother that you have never seen. I know you're going to ask me, Swami, hold on. I have seen my son, I see him every day. I say, no. You have not seen your son. You think you see your son. All you're looking at is matter and energy in a particular formation. That's why they're called forms. They form. That's what they're called forms. The English term for rupa is what? Form. F-O-R-M. Form. Because they form. They form. They construct. They form. They come together. They aggregate. The Pali term is kaya. It's an aggregation. It's a coming together. That's all it is. A body is all it is. That's all it is, a body. A body is an aggregation. That's all you have really seen with your eyes. But in your mind, you see something more than that. You don't stop at seeing simply an aggregation of matter. You see my son. That is a creation of your mind. So when you have this mental image of a son, which son? S-O-N. Right? That's the son I'm talking about. When you have that mental image of a son, and now you project that onto this physical form, see, things are going to happen to the physical form. Things are going to happen to the physical form because this is simply matter and energy. You know, if there's a young couple here in the audience, and perhaps you're planning on having children one day, I tell you, understand this before you go on to have a child. Otherwise, you will suffer. You're probably thinking, Swaminand, if I understand that, I won't need to have a child. I didn't say that. Well, I did, but I didn't. At least understand this before you have a child. You know, if it was down to me, this is what I would teach every young man and woman before they get married. Before they go on to have a child. But it's, you know, because simply, it's simply down to biology, everyone's allowed to have children. Everyone's just allowed to have children. But no one takes the effort to help them become responsible parents. That's why children suffer in the end. Don't you think a mother and a father, or before they become one, right? A couple before they choose to get married, don't you think the child that is to be born, don't you think that child must have a right to have the parents educated in the Dhamma before they decide to have them? Don't you think the child to be has a right to have their parents educated in the Dhamma so that they don't fight with each other before the child is born? But you're always going to fight when you see entities. Because here's what's going to happen. When the husband or the wife, they imagine a mental entity in their mind, and now they start projecting that onto the other person, the other spouse, that those things are going to change because those are simply manifestations of causes. Cause and effect is a phenomenon that determines all actions and all eventualities in this world. But in the mind of the man or the wife, they create a mental image of that, and now they project that onto the outside world. When those projections are not being fulfilled, now of course there's going to be conflict. It's one thing to bring a child into this world, but it's another to be a responsible father, a responsible mother, a responsible parent to that child. By my book, this has to be mandatory education before a couple are allowed to become parents. But no one listens to me, so it's okay. This should be mandatory education before two young people are allowed to get married, only because they can live a harmonious married life. I don't mean so that they then, you know, choose to come into robes. That's not what I mean. I mean at least so that they can live a happy life together. So that they just don't go around, you know, rather projecting their expectations on the other partner, expecting that to be fulfilled all the time. You know, you are evidence of that. Ladies and gentlemen in the house, you are evidence of how much you have been on the receiving end of expectations that have been put to you from the other partner, and how much that has hurt you. Both man and wife works the same way either way. That's because they were given a school education, but they were not given an education in the Dhamma. They didn't know how to manage the expectations. If an expectation was to be had, it had to be fulfilled. Why? Because as soon as you have an expectation, you begin to suffer. That's a vexation. So that vexation has to be relieved. And the only way people know to relieve their vexation is to change the outside world object to match their expectation. That's the only way people know. Because here's what they don't know. How do I undo my expectation? That they don't know. Here's what they do know. I expect, so therefore you change. I can see all of you nodding in agreement. Yeah? You know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. But, you know, the thing is, you do to each other, so, you know, it balances out, doesn't it? Tit for tat. Tell me you sympathize with this Swami Nuhansa if you can. Oh, poor thing, he's not even going to be married. I dare you. At the end of the sermon, I dare you. Come up to him and say, Swami Nuhansa, poor you. You're not even going to have a wife one day. You know, you're missing out on the good life. I dare you, if you can, come up to him and give him what you think is right. And then wait to hear what he has to tell you before you start plugging your ears. As I said, this is the truth. It's the bare truth. It's the simple truth. Here's what I want for today. Right? I understand, you know, these are some a little bit deep, some of the concepts that I'm talking about with you today. Like I said, I don't come here with an agenda, but I look at you, you seem interested, you seem engaged, and then, you know, I give you a sixer. Yeah, I mean, if there's ever going to be a day where, you know, you feel dull, you feel, you know, not disengaged, then I'm like, say something and get out. But, you know, there's never been a day like that. I don't expect there will be. Because you're here with purpose, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that. At least take this away from today as a learning point. This is simply this. Just a different arrangement. Okay? This is this. Just a simple arrangement. Difference in arrangement is all there is. But in your mind, you create an entity out of this. You think that there is a fully formed object here. Call it a flower, call it whatever. You think there's a fully formed object here. And it's complete. See? You see that this is complete. It's fully formed. It's complete. Do you not get that feeling? That is in your perception. That object is in your perception. It's in your mind. There is nothing about this object that qualifies to be called a fully formed object. Nothing about it. There's no difference between that and this. This is one arrangement. This is another arrangement. The letters of the alphabet are simply letters. You arrange them in different ways to create words. Did I bring the Scrabble one day to this sermon? Have I never brought the Scrabble letters? No. We did that at the monastery. When you play Scrabble, you take the same letters and you arrange them, you rearrange them, don't you? Yeah? You make one word and then at the end of the game you put it all back in the tile bag. Right? And the start of the next game, you take the same letters. Do they come as the words that you put in there? No, they come as plain letters. Do those letters belong to any particular words? No, they are distinct, standalone letters. They're independent letters. But when you form a word, what do you see? You see a word. That's an arrangement. That's all it is. It's just an arrangement. But your mind perceives it as one word. Your mind perceives it as a word. None of the letters know that. The letters are not even partaking in that activity. They're simply standing there like letters. The C, the A and the T don't know that they form a word together. The C is just a C. If you turn the C around and put it the wrong way around, do you think the C is going to complain? No, because the C doesn't know that it's now upside down. It doesn't know that. But someone does. In your perception, you do. So that's why if you ever see a tile that's turned upside down, in your perception, you know that that's wrong. So what you do is you take it up, you turn it around, and you fix it. In the same manner, ladies and gentlemen, when you have expectations of the outside world, you perceive these things in the outside world. Now, because generally people don't know what to do about expectations and how to rid themselves of expectations, what they do is they keep changing the outside world to meet their expectations. But the thing is this, it's a never-ending business. You can never be content that way. And you know the main reason for that? Your expectation itself is a manifestation. Thankfully, you don't understand the profoundness of what I'm explaining to you. Otherwise, you'd all get on a bus and come to the monastery with me today, I tell you. Your expectation itself is not a fixed entity. It is also a product of causes that are momentary. That's why today you tell her, I like your hair short. So she goes to the barber and she cuts it. But in the meantime, you think to yourself, you know what, actually, long hair is nice. I like her to have her long hair. And then she comes home and says, surprise, I've cut my hair. And you go, oh. How did the expectation change? Do you think expectations are fixed things? No, they're also products of causes that are present in the current moment. So even your expectation in the present moment is a creation of causes. This is cause and effect in its full effect. How then can you expect the world to please you? If you keep changing your mind, that's exactly what you're doing. You keep changing your mind. One. Here's another one. You just changed your mind. Yes. People think it's something like this. Here's the mind. Okay? Here's the mind. And then there are things that come into the mind. And they keep changing. Today you want fried rice. Tomorrow you want biryani. You changed your mind. No. You keep changing your mind. It's an individual chitta every single time. Each chitta is independent. Each chitta is an individual chitta. Each chitta is distinct. Each chitta is formed out of the causes that are present in that moment. Your drishti in this moment may be very different to your drishti in this moment. This is before watching TV. This is after watching TV. You've changed your mind. This chitta will never come again. It is here today and it will never come back again. This chitta will never come back again. It is here in the Pachupanna moment, and that is all it is. You keep changing your mind. So if you keep changing your mind, how can anyone satisfy you? Because what you want here is not what you want here. In this moment you want to see red, in this moment you want to see blue. So how can anyone satisfy you? Let alone the question, how can anyone satisfy you? I have a question to you. How can you ever be satisfied when you have a changing mind? Pandanang chapalang chittang. It's like a fish out of water. Have you seen a fish out of water? Yeah? Jumping up and down? Your mind is just like that. Each chitta only lasts a chitta moment. In the next chitta, it's something completely different. It's a brand new chitta, a different set of views, a different background, different causes. Psychology will teach you there's a mind that is constant and the mind takes on different objects. But Buddhist philosophy goes one step deeper. He says, no, this is not a constant mind that takes different objects. It's an individual chitta that takes an individual object. Aramana vijanan lakkhanan chittan. Each chitta is born to perceive the object that was there to give rise to it. That's all. But when ignorance comes in, all hell breaks loose, ladies and gentlemen. When ignorance steps in, here's what happens. When ignorance steps in, this chitta, it creates an entity. This chitta also creates an entity. Each chitta creates an entity or a perception of an entity. But the problem is this. When you create a perception of an entity, now you also create a future, you create a past, all within one chitta. Who was here last week? Honestly answer the question. Honestly, like in the way you actually feel it. Who was here last week? You were here last week. You don't have any doubt about that, do you? Today you might say, no, Swami knows, I realize it was not I who was here last week. There was some matter. It may not even be the same matter now. And it was just a chitta. Like those chittas are long gone. These chittas are the chittas that are present right now. They have nothing to do with each other. Right? So I don't even know who was there last week. Right? And even when I started this sentence, I'm a different person to what I am now. Because these are simply chittas that arise and pass away. Each one discrete. Each one independent. Each one created by the causes that are present in the moment of their creation. That you will say now. But if you ask yourself, ignore the Dhamma for a second, who was here last week? You were here last week. And who preached last week? Swami Nasi preached last week. That is because even in this moment, you create something called an entity. I'm so sorry. Wake up. See? Heavy lifting. What was I going to say? When you create an entity, right? You think that it was this Swami Nuhanse who was here last week. That is something you think right now. Right now you open your eyes and you create a chitta. In that chitta you see an object, right? But you create an entity. The moment you create an entity, it has an existence. Because entities do what? They exist. If something exists, you have to put it on the timeline. Because how can you exist without time and space? Yeah? So these are the things that physicists study. They study time, they study space. Because of course, they're talking about existences. So now you have an entity that has to exist, and they exist on the time, on the axis of time. So therefore, now you go back to memory. And from memory you bring back a picture that resembles this, more or less. And then you say, yes, Swami was here last week. And so was I. These are all creations in the present moment. You create your timeline in the present moment. You did that in the previous chitta also. You did that in the chitta before that also. These are not all the same timelines. These are all individual timelines. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't realize how difficult it is to live. You think the life that you live is difficult, right? You know, the paying the bills, looking after the children, cooking, you know, cleaning, dishwashing and all that. Do you realize how much your mind has to work just to make, just to give meaning to your existence because you think that things exist? It has to create this whole universe. I'll give you one simple evidence just to prove to you that this time is a creation of your mind. Give me a show of hands if you've ever experienced a deja vu. You may not know what it is called, so I'll explain to you what a deja vu is in a moment. But if you know what it is, just give me a show of hands. A deja vu. Alright, that's good. About half the room. A deja vu is basically when you, in the present moment, feel like you've been through this situation before. But you know that it cannot be true. It's like, we've been here before, haven't we? You and I, just like this, we've... Swami knows us here, this lady was here. We've been through this before. Have you not experienced that? Yeah, that's a deja vu. When you have these deja vu moments, right? That's a glitch in the system. When you have a deja vu moment, don't you honestly feel that this is a moment from the past? You know that, you honestly feel, you perceive that this is a moment from the past. But don't you know that this such a thing has never happened in the past? Thankfully you know that. So what you know conflicts with what you perceive. That is why you feel this mismatch. But if I ask you to think about something that actually happened yesterday, you have no problem. You don't feel that conflict. But when you have a deja vu moment, now you have a conflict. Because for that split second, you feel like, wait, I just perceive like we've been through this before, but it couldn't have because this is the first time I'm meeting this person. This set of circumstances could never have happened before. Right? But what's going on is this in a deja vu. You're perceiving what's here right now. That's all that's going on. You're simply perceiving what your eyes are seeing. But in your mind, you're creating time. You're creating time, and the creation of time there has a bit of a glitch. And because of that glitch, rather than perceiving the present moment, you're perceiving the past. Instead of perceiving the present, you're perceiving the past. So therefore, these two things together, what two things together? What your eyes are seeing and what your mind is creating as a past, you know, and a notion of the past. These two things put together, this is the glitch. Now you feel, hang on, this happened in the past. But of course it didn't, because you're not bringing this back from memory. You couldn't be bringing it back from memory. Why? You've not been through that before, so it cannot be in your memory. This is happening for the first time. But in your mind, you create a notion of the past. So what does that tell you about the mind? Or what does that tell you about time then? It's a creation of the mind. This sense that you have that you did something yesterday, that's a creation of the present moment. You create time. You create that time. This notion that you're going to do something after you get home today, that's also a creation of the mind. Why does the mind create that? Because the mind creates entities. You see, you exist, don't you? Ignore the Dhamma for a second and answer this question. You exist, don't you? Yeah. So if you exist, you have to have a past, you have to have a future, and you are in the present. But that's a big fat lie. You don't exist. Existence as you know does not exist. All there is in the present moment, there is matter, there's energy, these are all manifestations of the causes that are present in the current moment. Please do understand that this is not the past of this or the future of this. Once again, this is not the future of this. But I can break this now. And then you'll think, see Swami Nahansa, this was the past and this is the future. No. This is not the past of this. This is not the future of this. This is simply an arrangement right now. This is another arrangement right now. All there are arrangements in the present moment. This has no future. This has no past. All there is the Pachupanna arrangement. That's all there is. If that is so, who are you? How old are you then? How old are you? You are brand new. So then you can go back home feeling very young, rejuvenated. You are not X number of years, X number of weeks, X number of months, X number of days old. I'm talking about the effect that manifests in the present moment. It has only come about because of the causes that are present in this moment. See, I say apple. Now you're thinking apple. I say banana. Now you're thinking banana. What happened to the you that thought the apple? Where did they go? Where did they go? Let's try that again. Apple. Now you are thinking apple. Banana. Now you are thinking banana. Where did the person that was thinking the apple go? Where did they go? Where did they go? They were nowhere. Exactly. It's just a different arrangement because there was a chitta. When I said the word apple, there was a chitta that was born that heard the word apple and it perceived apple. That's it. That passed away. The moment the causes ceased to exist, the effect ceased to exist. And then I said the word banana. And then that word was perceived. Your system worked, your eardrums vibrated, right? Your nervous system started to work, your brain got into action, and your chitta was created. And then you heard the word banana. It was a perception. So where's that chitta now? Where's that you now? There was no such you. There are no yous. There are simply chittas that arise and pass away. But if you don't understand this, you think that there is a you that exists. And if there's a you that exists, now, along with that comes death. See, try and see how you can figure out how along with that you have death as part and parcel of that. What can die? Things that exist. Can something that doesn't exist die? What is death after all? The cessation of existence. Where does existence happen? In your mind. So where is death? In your mind. You've never died. You never will die. You think you die. I know, now you're asking me, Swami Nahansa. About 2 weeks ago, you talked about death. And you said we must all be earnestly practicing the path and be heedful and act diligently because death is coming. It's just around the corner, right? And we don't have all the time in the world. And so hurry up. And now you're saying there's no such thing called death. Swami Nahansa, are you mad or are you mad? We speak in two dimensions. These are entirely different paradigms. You know, they're both true. One's a conventional truth, the other's an absolute truth. But they're both true. This is a fan. And it's not one at the same time. In the conventional sense, this is a fan. In the absolute sense, it is not a fan. It is merely arrangement of matter. if I split this in half, the conventional truth people will perceive that the fan is now broken and I have half a fan in my hand. But the people who have seen the absolute truth, they will not perceive such a thing. A fan has to be created in your mind before it can be broken. Other than that, it is simply matter. In one place, it's in another place. That's it. See, take this leaf for instance. You think this leaf is intact. If I could place these two parts together, right, with no distance between the peripheral layer of cells, and as close as they were before I tore it, right, what difference is there? Once again, if I could put these pieces back, hold these pieces back together, okay, and bring them close back together and keep them as close as they were before I tore it, because there's a border of cells here and there's another line of cells here, right? If I can bring them back together and keep them just hand in hand, adjacent to each other, just like they were before I tore it, what do I have in my hand now? Is it two parts of a leaf? But don't you perceive that it is torn now? See, conventionally, it is a torn leaf. In absolute terms, it is not. This is just matter. There was no leaf to be torn. It was just matter. When you perceive this as an object, now you perceive death. You perceive decay. See? Decay. If you leave it till tomorrow, you'll perceive old age. All because you perceive entities. That's why you suffer. You create suffering and you live it and you experience it. Now, if the Dhamma can help you to stop thinking like that, don't you feel that if I can do it, you can do it? Is there anything more for you to do other than understanding the Dhamma? You know, we've been talking now, what, for, started around 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, almost 11:30, but almost 3 hours now. Have you understood nothing from today? You've understood something, right? You've all understood something. Most of you may have understood pretty much all of it. Others might have understood some of it. Others will be, you know, in between, right? But you've all understood something. And does that something at least not tell you that these entities are perceived in your mind? That there are no such things called fixed things in this world. There's merely arrangements of matter and energy. But in our minds we create these entities and then we project them onto the outside world. And here's what we do next. We expect them to conform to the expectations that we have for the entities that we have created in our own minds. And then of course, once you have expectations, you have disappointments. When you are disappointed, you grieve. That is called sorrow. When you have the expectation waiting for it to be fulfilled, you live in fear. Because what if will always be with you. That's why the Buddha says, Tanha jayati soko, tanha jayati bhaya. Tanha vipamuttasa natti soko kuto bhaya. When there is tanha, which is attachment, there's always an expectation. So please don't think that to have expectations is a good thing. Because some come up and ask, you know, sometimes people come up and ask, Swami answer, but if we didn't have any expectations, how would we live? Would life be livable without expectations? Yes, you can live. To live, all you need is a chitta to arise and pass away. You don't need an expectation-bound chitta. You just need a chitta. Put an object in front of you, a chitta arises. Put a sound in front of you, a chitta arises. Open your 5 senses and a chitta arises. That's all you need to live. You don't need expectations to live. You only need expectations to suffer. But because people have never known a life without expectations, they can't imagine what I'm talking about. That's the problem. People have never known a life without expectations. At least when you open your eyes, don't you expect to be able to see? That's the problem. See, so you've never known a life without expectations. Every time you open your eyes, remember, don't take this lightly. Every time you open your eyes, you expect to be able to see. Every time you breathe in, you expect to be able to breathe. Just imagine if this were to happen. If you went deaf all of a sudden. What if all of a sudden? See? What if that happened all of a sudden? Were you not expecting to hear the rest of that sentence? Point proven. I rest my case. You expected to hear the rest of that sentence. That's why all of a sudden when the room went blank, you're like, what's going on? That is your mind going, where's the rest of it? Come on, where's the rest of it? See how vexed your mind is. Now just imagine what an arahant must be like. You think your problems are trying to pay the bills. You think your problems are, how do I put my child to a good school? How do I get my daughter married off to a good man? How do I pay the mortgage? How do I get that new car? How do I get that loan? How do I pay off my credit cards? You think these are the problems in life? You haven't even begun. That is Montessori. I'm talking about university. At university, the problems that we have is when I open my eyes, I expect to see. That's a problem. I still have that problem. That's my problem. What's yours? My problem, sir, is that when I open my eyes, I expect to be able to see. I have a problem with that. What's your problem? Inflation. Gas prices going up. Sometimes it feels like we are worlds apart. But that's okay. Have faith. If I can do it, you can do it. If Swaminasa can do it, I can do it. I'm trying to introduce you to a different kind of problem. And that problem is what the Buddha preached in his first sermon. Idam dukkham. Pubbe ananusute sudhammesu. Chakkum udapadi. Jnanam udapadi. Vijja udapadi. Aloko udapadi. That's the problem that he discovered. The ultimate problem. The most fundamental problem. All other problems stem from that problem. That's why I am today digging at the roots. You are climbing up the tree. Pruning the branches. When are you going to get down to the root of the tree? I have the tools you need. I have the crowbar. I have the shovel. I have the mammoty. All we have to do is uproot this. We have to dig it at the roots and topple the tree. But you are too busy climbing up the tree, plucking the fruits. You think by pruning the branches, one day the tree will die. It won't, dear mothers and fathers, it won't. My dear brothers and sisters, it won't. You have to get down that tree. Jati is the problem. Dukkha is the problem. Not the mundane dukkha that you know of. The dukkha that the Buddha discovered. That's the problem. This creation of an entity, that is dukkha. Creation of an existence, that is dukkha. Because then you can't help a future and a past from being created. You imagine this in your world. See, don't you live in fear of tomorrow? What if tomorrow never comes? That's one problem. And what about when it does come? That's the other problem. See? You always live in fear of tomorrow. But you have no choice but to wait till tomorrow. It's a trap, don't you think? When you have no choice but to face the problem, but you don't like the problem either, and you have nothing to do about the problem. I mean, that's a real trap. You cannot do anything about tomorrow coming your way, but when it does come, you don't know what to do about it. See? It's the ultimate trap. I like to call it the perfect trap. That's why you need the perfect one. To come around, to come about, and show you that there's a bit of a loophole. He comes and finds the loophole. He says, earn merits and engage in kusal. With these two things, refrain from unmeritorious deeds, engage in meritorious deeds, engage in cleansing your mind from defilements. And once you do that, you will find the loophole out of this trap. Sabba papa sakaruna. Kusala supasampada sachitta pariyodapana. And that is the Buddha Sasana. The Buddha Sasana is your way out of this perfect trap. So do continue to earn as much merits as you possibly can. Someone told me last week that this is apparently the 49th sermon. 49? I didn't know we'd done 49 sermons. So the week after we'll have the 50th. Is it this next week? 50th. So I've been preaching to you 50 times. What have you been doing? What has 50 sermons done to you? I have a question. What have 50 sermons done to you? Has it done anything? I hope so. I hope so. Ah, okay. You're writing about it. But I want you to see the end of this. You know, this is not just a get-together. Right? Because you do that all the time. Right? As a community you get together, as a family you get together, as lions you get together, as tigers you get together, as sheep, you whatever, you get together. You get together. As alumni, you get together. All schools, all boys, all girls, you get together. All colleagues of yours, they get together. Rotarians, they get together. Interactors, they get together, right? You have your various get-togethers. Family get-togethers, Christmas do's, and all sorts. So this is not another get-together. This is not to get together. This is the get-together to not get together. I want that for all of you. Thanks to the Maha Sangha, thanks to the Buddha, and the lineage of the noble ones, This is what they fought for. You know, it was no easy fight. One day I'll explain to you the sacrifices that they made. There were times, ladies and gentlemen, when there were severe droughts. There were severe droughts. Famine struck. In those times, you know, there was no food to eat, no water to drink. Life was incredibly hard. And bear in mind that monks, bhikkhunis, they're at the mercy of those who have. If the monks in the day, you know, if they didn't have anything to eat, they couldn't go and do some trade and earn something. They couldn't go and sell something they had in exchange, because what do they have to sell? They have nothing to sell. So they were at the mercy of devotees. So when the devotees don't have, what do the monks have? When the devotees don't have, what do the monks have? Nothing. But our lineage of the bhikkhus, there were times where they had absolutely nothing. And they knew that, you know, these devotees, these villages, they have nothing. So therefore, let's not go on arms round. Let's not bother them. Sometimes people would not welcome them. They would chase them away. But then there were others who were very wise. There were some devotees who were very wise. They realized the reason that we don't have today is because we have not given. And if the venerable monks, if the venerable bhikkhus are willing to come our way, if we have one grain of sand, let's give that. If one grain of rice, let's give that. If we have a drop of water in our pitcher, let's give that. Because today we don't have, as we have not given. There were some who were very wise and they understood that. But then, when everything became almost non-existent, no water, no food, there are many stories of how monks preserved the sasana, their mouths dry, their bodies down to the bone, and yet they kept on practicing the Dhamma. And the arahants at the time, they wanted their younger bhikkhus, the samaneras, to come and learn the Dhamma. So they continued to preach. And there were occasions when they just didn't have the energy to preach. You know what they did then? They took sandbags and then put them on their stomachs, because that would sort of bellow them. So the noise would come out, because your diaphragm has to work so that you can push the air out of your lungs, right? They just didn't have the energy to do that. So they'd use sandbags. And the monk would lay on the ground. The student monk would come up to his teacher. They'd use a sandbag and compress it on the stomach, so that as the air got pushed out, he could utter something. The pristine Dhamma. And they listened to it and they learnt it. And they memorized that. That is how today we have the Buddha Sasana. That is why with every cell in my body, I'm indebted to the Buddha Sasana. With every cell in my body. Today, the bliss that I enjoy, I talked to you a moment ago at the start, I have been through what you're going through right now, the fear, the worry, the grief, all that. Today, I'm free from that because of the Buddha Sasana. And I know this is what they treasured. This is what they passed down through the noble lineage all the way down to us. That is why, ladies and gentlemen, even today, when we do a merit transfer, we transfer these merits to any of those bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected the Sambuddha Sasana by handing it down, word to word, mouth to mouth, they've passed it down to us. The only medicine there is to mental suffering. The only medicine there is. You can't buy this from a pharmacy. You can't. This has to come through the Buddha. And it has to pass to the generation of the noble lineage. That's why I say, in an era where we have it at our disposal, that's why I invite you and I encourage you all, do whatever you can in your power to take this Dhamma, and make it yours and fight for your freedom, this chance may never come to you again. This is not one in a million. This is not one in a billion. This is one in a I don't know what. It's not something we come across every day. If we did, you and I wouldn't be here today. Yes? There you go. Point proven. If you come across this every day, you and I wouldn't be here today, right? But how long have you come through in samsara and you are still here? Just imagine how difficult it must be to come across this teaching. How much merits must one need to come across this teaching? How blessed one must be to come across this teaching? That's why I always appeal to you. For those who still have youthfulness within you, for those who still have energy within you, strive. Ask yourselves if you are doing enough. I think each and every one of you can do a little bit more. I know I'm speaking on your behalf, but I think each and every one of you can do a little bit more. Some of you can do a lot more. But for some reason you're hesitant. But then one day the opportunity will pass. And then all there will be left is regret. Remember, regret stings. It stings forever. If you were unkind to your wife who left you, today you remember that. And you regret, and that's all you have. If you didn't pay attention to your mother, if you didn't look after her when she was with you, today you regret, and there is no remedy for that. Once regret stings you, that's it. There's no coming out of it. So, if that is so about your mother, about your wife, then I ask you about your ultimate salvation. This is all we have. Once this is gone, this is gone. The sasana apparently will stay with us for another 2,500 years, but what good is that to you if you are going to die tomorrow? If you are going to end next week, what good is the fact that the sasana is going to be here for another 2,500 years? It's good for the rest of them, but what good is it for you? Think about this, please. If today you are too engrossed in other matters, please remember that all of those things that you are engaged in today will all end with you. You cannot carry any of that with you. Perhaps you are reading for your PhD. Okay, you'll get it, and then when you die, you leave it. But if you become a sotapanna, that you take with you. Within a maximum of 7 lives, you will attain nibbana, become an arahant. See, these are the things that will endure. But how willing people are to sacrifice those things which will endure for those things that are very superficial, that will only be with you so temporarily. Earn all the money in the world, but when you leave empty-handed. Get married to the most beautiful woman out there. When you leave empty-handed. Name one thing that is worth doing in your material pursuits. One thing if you can. Besides practicing the path, working towards your salvation. Name one thing that is worthwhile. That is why this is called. This is the noble goal. This is the ultimate goal. Every other goal, you will fail. Very temporary. So once again, I appeal to those of you who have energy left within you, who have vigor, who have strength, because you will need it. This battle is not easy. That much I'll tell you. It's not easy. But it's far better than this, because it's worthwhile. But it's not easy. So, it's easier if you start early. Start early while you can. And the Mahasangha is here to provide for you, to help you, to support you. There are only about 25,000 monks or something in Sri Lanka. And every day they are disrobing. They are disrobing like it's going out of business. Every day disrobing. And that's why every time we go to Malwatta for our high ordination, the venerable monks over there, the Mahanayaka Theras, they are gobsmacked to see how come we have so many monks. This year also we have 20 Samanera monks who we are presenting for the high ordination. Which may be about 1/10 of all of the monks who come to Malwatta for their high ordination. That is not a miracle of our monastery. It's not. It's a miracle of the Dhamma. Wherever the Dhamma exists, people will ordain. People will come into the sasana. Where the Dhamma prevails, the truth prevails. People are all truth seekers. We are all truth seekers. Once you see the truth, you will come to the light. You will. You just need to see the truth. So it doesn't surprise me that people are disrobing every other day. It doesn't surprise me. Because they came looking for the truth, couldn't find it. Well, better disrobe than do something you're not supposed to do. In robes. The fact of the matter is, you have it at your doorstep. Please think wisely and make a decision on your behalf. All of this is for you, ladies and gentlemen. All of it is for you. Whether you do it, it's yours. If you don't do it, it's still yours. I get my merits anyway by going and doing this sermon. Right? It's like when you cook alms for the monks, whether they eat it or not, have you not earned the merits? Because merits is not in the food or how much of it is eaten, right? It's in the intention. My intention is for all of you to attain Nibbana. Thereby, I have already earned my merits. So what I need to do, I have done. Now the ball is in your court. So mothers, fathers in the room, if you have young children, please think about what is best for them, what's right for them. If you still have youth on your side, think about what's best for you. Everything else you're going to leave behind. Everything you're going to leave behind. So much so that what you have today was once your father's. I rest my case. Yes? What you have today was once your father's. He went, he left. And what was his was once his father's, your grandfather's. He went, he left. What he left, you took over. What you leave, the next one will take over. You will leave empty-handed. What do you do for yourselves? Earn something that you can take with you, is what I'm saying. I have a brief announcement to make. We have Vesak coming up, which is going to be on a Thursday. So, as you'd expect, at the monastery we have a very special Sambuddha Puja. We call it our family Sambuddha Puja because all of our devotees, all of the monks, Anagarikas, Anagarikas, and all of the residents at the monastery, we all join one big parahara as we bring something to offer the Supreme One. And you all have an opportunity to take part in that. What you have to do is simply to turn up on the day. That alone is enough, even if you just turn up on the day. You can take part in the proceedings of the day. But if you wish to join that parahara, then for each family, so not one per person, but one per family. Because if you bring one per person, we won't have enough room. I think last time also we had around 600 or so. But because it's only one day of the week, one day of the year, so we give everyone the opportunity to do that. So for one per family, you can make something at home. You know, like what you bring on Sunday mornings to offer Swami Nuhansi. Make something at home. Get everyone involved in that. That's what you need to do. It doesn't need to be something extra special. Something really simple. If all you can bring is a carrot sliced, that's perfectly fine. But just make sure that everyone at home slices the carrot. Because it has to be a family thing. What you don't realize is you have all come on this journey together. And now you are at the door of Nibbana. Chances are, each and every one of you in the family has some right to walk through that door. it is down to you to try and pave the path for them. Because it might be that only you come to the sermons, you are engaged in this manner, but perhaps others in the family are not so much yet. It's your responsibility. They love you, you know that, right? It's your responsibility to try and pave the path for them to attain their salvation also. So get them all involved. Even if all of them can't come to the monastery, at least they've taken part in that. So just one dish of some sort, and these dishes are not supposed to be massive dishes, right? Just something about the size of this, or even smaller. This cup that I have here, even smaller is perfectly fine. Just bring one thing, and your family can also join the procession, and we will all come in the Parihara, make our offerings. We will do the Sambuddha Puja on the day, and then of course there will be a sermon by Guru Swami Nuhanse at the end of that. You can all take part in that as well, and just use that as an opportunity to earn lots and lots and lots of merits, because we need that on our path to salvation. So that invitation is there to everyone in the family. I mean, if you feel you're part of the family, if not, you are all my family. I don't feel any difference between you and I. Chittas, that's all. Right? So the invitation is there. We'd like to see you all at the monastery. If you can make it, then please come along. Right, let's conclude for today. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, listening to the Dhamma and inviting the Swami Nuhansi to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, Upasakas and Upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to all monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends at the monastery, our devotees who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, husbands and wives, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as those who have taken every effort to make our lives comfortable, those who have gone the extra mile on our behalf, who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits may they also be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers and our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do and are able to practice the the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these messages to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as friends and foe who have lost their lives in the wars. Let us transfer this message to those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends to us, those who would have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits out of compassion and gratitude to all of them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Arahatan Vahanse or an Arahatarinin Vahanse in this life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer the blessings to you.
Raga ginnan nidatnva, desha ginnan nidatnva, moha ginnan nidatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Raga gini nireva Dvesha gini nireva Moha gini nireva Nivan sata labeva Nivan sata labeva Nivan sata labeva
Tunuruvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Silu loka silu satyoma Nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu